So I promised to have this done by 12:35, so you can set your stopwatch. I've given this talk over 200 times, mostly. My favorite place to give this talk, called Defending the Eucharist, is in Capernaum, at the synagogue where Jesus spoke these words, "Eat my flesh and drink my blood." I've given this talk 100 times there alone, at the church, at the Capernaum synagogue. And when we do the readings at Mass, if you don't know this, when you're in the Holy Land, the readings are site-specific. They don't follow the Magnificat or the readings of the day. Every site that you're at, the readings are always that site. So for the site of the Beatitudes, it's always the Gospel of the Beatitudes. At the Church of Capernaum, where Peter lived and Jesus lived, and the synagogues are, it's always John chapter 6. And I tell the bishop or the deacon when we have Mass there, when you read all about eat my flesh and drink my blood, eat my flesh and drink my blood, when the last verse of that reading, it says, these words were spoken in the synagogue at Capernaum. When you say that, I said, I want you to point and say, these words are spoken in that synagogue right out the window. Very profound. I had a guy one time say to me, I'm a reluctant pilgrim. I'm only here because my wife made me come. She went fishing with me last year, so I promised I'd come here with her. So here I am. I said, I'm not worried about you, sir. After that Mass, where we had Mass at the place where Jesus said, eat my flesh and drink my blood, he came out of the Mass with tears running down his eyes, and he said, I'm not a reluctant pilgrim anymore. I just realized where I am. So I want to talk a little bit about the Eucharist. First of all, just so you'll know, because people don't know, this is my Gospel of St. John. When I go give conferences, a lot of times they introduce me and say, Steve Ray, the author of St. John's Gospel. I said, don't I wish? But I wrote a book about it. And when I'm talking about John chapter 6, and it's in here, so it gives you all the Jewish background and the words and culture. And my book, Crossing the Tiber, which is my conversion story, the last third of it is all about the Eucharist. It's all about the Bible passages and the first 4 centuries. What did the very first Christians believe about the Eucharist? Believe me, they were Catholic, but I didn't realize that for the first 39 years of my life, and I'm going to tell you about that. Then I made a whole bunch of movies, 9 of them, all on location. This one is on Moses. It was filmed all in Egypt and Mount Sinai, on the top of Sinai and Jordan. And in here, it's about the sacraments, because all the sacraments are prefigured in Moses. So we talk about how the Eucharist is that, the manna, and the manna is a type of the Eucharist, and so on. And lastly, I have 2 talks on the Eucharist. The one I'm giving today is here, if you want to get it and give it to somebody. And I also came up with this one, is the Mass really a sacrifice? So the two go together. Okay, now I got that done. My wife will be happy with me that I did that. So I am... I've done a lot of things, I know, writing books and all that, but I just have to say to you guys that the thing I'm proudest of in my whole life, and I've run several businesses and I lead pilgrimages and books and made movies and everything else, the thing I'm proudest of is I've been in, tomorrow will be my anniversary. I've been married to the same beautiful woman for 46 years and I love her more now than I did before. And I have 4 kids. The oldest one is 43, the youngest one is 28, and they're all Catholic apologists and defenders of the faith, and I've got 19 grandchildren. And if you ever try to get any of my 19 grandchildren out of the Catholic faith, I'll tell you right now, they'll bite your head off. They are good. They are good with apologetics and scripture, and they love the Lord. So this is what I'm proudest of. Now I want to jump right into this. I wasn't always a Catholic, and I was a Baptist, and when we started thinking about coming Catholics, I knew that there was a big change that I was going to have to think about in this whole matter of the Eucharist. Because for us as Baptists, I'll tell you really quickly what our service was. And I'm not trying to make fun of it or make light of it, but it was a very different thing than what you as Catholics do. So when we used to come to church, it was only we had communion. Now, there's a bunch of different Protestant denominations, so there's all different kind of permutations and ways it's done. In my traditions, and I went to about 5 or 6 different Baptist, Evangelical, Methodist, Reformed churches, and on so on. But in our churches, what they would do is 4 times a year we had what's called the Lord's Supper or Communion. We would never call it a sacrament or the Eucharist because that was Catholic and the Catholics are wrong. So we would have what was called Communion and they would pass a tray. After the service, only 4 times a year, the preacher would preach everything. We'd sing the last psalm and then everybody'd sit down and then they would come for the next 15 minutes. We'd have Communion and the ushers would pass a tray around. You didn't come up for the Eucharist, the Lord's Supper where we went. You stayed in your pews and they passed a tray, kind of like the offering plate, except this time you didn't put something in, you took something out. There was saltine crackers broken up into pieces, and as the tray went by, you each took a piece of saltine cracker, and when you all had the saltine cracker, the pastor would stand up and pray. And it was usually a very reverent prayer about how we're grateful that Jesus died for our sins and so on. And then he would say something like, "And we thank you that this piece of bread, cracker, reminds us of what you did for us. You gave your body for us." And we all knew that nothing happened up there. There was no magic. There was nothing changed. It was just a piece of bread, and it reminded us that Jesus died on the cross and gave his body for us. Well, we'd all eat that bread, and then we'd sit back down. Then another tray would come by, and it would go back and forth down the aisles. But this one was a little different. It was a little bit deeper, and it had holes in it, and in each one of those holes was a little glass. Kind of the best way I could describe it is a little shot glass. And that was full of Welch's grape juice, not wine. Welch's grape juice, because the devil lives in that bottle of wine. Now, my mom and dad, they would never drink wine as long as there was any other Baptist in the room. But if there weren't, then they'd say, "Get us a bad glass of that rosé." They say if you go fishing and you're going to bring beer, if there's two Baptists, there will not be one can of beer drunk. But if you have only one, they'll drink them all. So, I mean, this is, I know this because I was a Baptist. I know this is a joke. Anyway, so then this glasses of grape juice would come along, and everybody would take a little glass, this shot glass of grape juice. And when everybody had one, we'd stand up, and then we'd pray the same kind of prayer. "Thank you that you shed your blood for us, and it washes away our sins," and so on. And it was a reverent prayer. I don't mean to be deprecating here. And then when the pastor done praying, we'd all drink that Welch's grape juice. And then you don't know about this, but in Protestant churches, in the front of the pew, in the back of the pew in front of you, there's a little wooden lip every couple feet. And in there, there's three holes with rubber inserts. And when you're done drinking the little glass, you put it in the inserts, and then the ladies come later and they pick it up and clean it and get it ready for 3 months from now. Now, just to show you there was no sense of reverence at all or sacredness to this, really, is after that service was over, my brothers and I knew that there was a little bit of Welch's grape juice left in all of those glasses. So we went up and down the pews and licked out and sucked out all the last few drops of Welch's grape juice from all of those glasses in the church. Why my mother let me do this, I have no idea. And why I didn't get some incurable disease, I have no idea. But that was my experience of the Lord's Supper until I was 39 years old. Now I'm at 39 and I'm going through this crisis, and I'm not going to tell you about my conversion story. I don't have time. I've only got 30 minutes left. But I was going through this whole, the problems with Protestantism. That's what eventually drew me into the Catholic Church, as I saw the problems with Protestantism. That's another whole talk maybe I'll come back and do next year on my conversion story. But when we were going through this process, I realized that there's My only understanding of what Catholics did on Sunday morning is from TV and what I've read or what I've seen in pictures or whatever, because I had never, ever set foot in a Catholic church out of principle. I would never go in a Catholic church, nor did I ever meet a priest in my life, nor did I ever meet a Catholic who could explain or defend their faith. I used to pick you guys off the tree like a ripe peach because I knew the Bible and you didn't, and I knew all the verses to twist you into pieces, into a pretzel. I'll show you a couple of them as we go along. So I realized that what you guys did was worshiped a piece of bread. And we could not comprehend the fact that we'd see a picture of a big thing up here, like a gold, what's called monstrance. I know that now, but I didn't know that then. And there's a piece of bread in there, and you guys would all come down and worship a piece of bread. And we said, "This is crazy. We Baptists, we worship a living Christ in heaven, a God and living in God. And Catholics worship a cookie Christ." That's what we used to call it. Graven bread, because you made an idol out of it. You're not supposed to make any graven images. And Catholics bowed down and worshiped a graven bread, an idol. And they were idolatrous. And if it is only a piece of bread, then I was totally right. You guys are guilty of idolatry and, let's face it, stupidity to bow down and worship a piece of bread. But when our conversion process started, I realized that there's only two real positions. There's not a lot of wiggle room in between. It is either crackers and grape juice, or it is the body and blood of Christ. And if it is the real body and blood of Christ, and I make fun of it, then I'm in big trouble on Judgment Day. But if it is only crackers and grape juice, and I partake of it, worship it, then I am guilty of idolatry and stupidity. So I had to make a decision, because my eternal soul would depend on the decision I made on how I viewed what happens up here at a Catholic altar. So this is how we came to the conclusion, my wife and I, after a lot of study. We also went through the issues of the papacy and the priesthood and purgatory and everything else. But this one, I'm just going to focus in on the Eucharist. Now, normally when I have an hour to do this talk, I did it in South Carolina a couple days ago for an hour and a half. I've got a half an hour today. Normally I go through the Old Testament and show you all how the Old Testament prepares you for the Eucharist. It gives you prefigurations, typology, images, like the Passover lamb, like the manna, like the bulls that were slain, all these things that give you images of what is to come, so that when the Eucharist actually arrives, you say, aha, of course, look at, there it is in the manna, in the Passover lamb, in the bulls, in all of these other things. And it's fascinating study, but I don't have time to do it today. So what I want to do, I'm going to give you only one. Two. The Passover lamb. They had to get out of Egypt. And they had to have a Passover lamb. They had to kill the lamb. What did they do with the blood? They put it on the lintel and doorposts of the house, vertical and horizontal beams of the wood. And then they had to eat the meat of the lamb before they could leave Egypt. What do we do at the Mass? We also have the blood of the lamb, and it's on vertical and horizontal beams of the wood, but it's the cross. And we also have to eat the meat of the lamb, the Eucharist, before we get up and leave. So remember that, because it plays into what I'm going to talk about later. The second one is the bulls. When Jesus says in the upper room, this is my blood of the new covenant, which will be shed for you. How many of you, when you hear that, think, well, if this is the covenant, the new covenant, what was the old covenant? When you go back and look at Exodus chapter 2, 24, verse 8, it tells you what the blood of the first covenant was. Moses and the children of Israel were in the wilderness. They were all gathered together. The young guys, some of you young guys would be recruited to do this. You were the ones that brought the bulls into the room, into the center of the people. Bulls, big, you know, those big two-ton kind of thing. We had cows when I was a kid. I know what bulls are like. None of you guys would be sitting on those aisle seats, believe me, if this was back in the old covenant, because those bulls would be coming up the aisle, kicking and bellowing, and when they got them up here, they had to kill them, and it said that Moses put the blood of the bulls in the bowls. Say that 10 times fast, blood of the bulls in the bowls. How do you get the blood of bulls into bowls? Just think of this. You got a 2-ton bull. They got to slice his throat. Somebody's got to pick and hoist that thing up so that the blood will drain out of him. And then it goes into these big bowls. Have you ever seen real blood like that? I lived on a farm. We killed animals. I know what it's like. Dad would sometimes call from work and say, Steve, go out and get a rooster and kill him and get him ready for dinner. So that's what I did. Took out a hatchet, whopped off his head, cleaned him, and we had rooster for dinner. But I know what it's like to have the... When you have blood like that, it immediately turns into coagulant clots. And flies come because it stinks. And then says that Moses took the blood from the bulls and he splattered it on the people. Can you imagine? Just imagine, I'm throwing these blood clots on you. Splat, splat. And now you go back to your tent. You don't have a shower. You don't have a washing machine. Why did Moses do that to us? But this is the blood of the new covenant. And now Jesus is talking about, this is my blood. I mean, that's the old covenant. This is my blood of the new covenant. Everything in that in this talk I give is the Mass really a sacrifice. I go through all of those Old Testament situations and show you that everything Jesus says in the upper room is already sacrificial language. Of course the Mass is a sacrifice. Just get to know your Bibles and you'll realize that. Well, anyway, so I did the Passover lamb and the bulls. I do a whole bunch of other things normally, but I'm going to jump right into the New Testament now. So we had to start thinking about... Looking at the Bible, see, what I was born with a Baptist pair of glasses on. My mother, as soon as I was born, she said, we read the Bible alone, and that's all. But I realized that wasn't true, because we were born with a pair of Baptist glasses, and this was our Baptist tradition. We did not read the Bible alone. We read the Bible through our Baptist tradition. And the Bible had to conform to our Baptist tradition, which is why my mother used to say there are certain Bible verses that just don't make sense for us. I just put them on the shelf because they didn't fit her Baptist tradition. But now as a Catholic, all the Bible verses fit and it makes sense now. There's no Bible verses I have to set on the shelf. They're all integrated. So when we come to the upper room, I want to start with this one, the upper room of Jesus. There were the first three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, talk about the institution of the Eucharist in the upper room. John does not. John does something different. He gives you John chapter 6, where he prepares you for what's going to happen in the upper room. In fact, when we pull into Capernaum, we're always there early because I hate lines. I'm always the first one everywhere with our group, so we don't have to stand in lines. And while we're waiting for the gates to open at Capernaum, you see the big sign. The Church of the Promise of the Eucharist. In Capernaum, in John chapter 6, we do not have Jesus in the upper room. We have him explaining the theology and promising the Eucharist and telling us what it is. So in the upper room, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they're called the Synoptic Gospels. Syn, S-Y-N, not S-I-N. S-Y-N means with. Optics means to see. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are the synoptics. They see things alike, together, because they have a lot of the same stories and parables and miracles. John is completely different. So those three, I just want to touch on those. They go to the upper room. And Jesus and the disciples, he said, to prepare the upper room for me. And they go to the upper room. And immediately we notice a problem when we read Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The problem in the upper room for a Passover meal is there's no mention of a lamb. You have to have a lamb for a Passover meal. There's no mention of a lamb. And there's no priest. You have to have a priest. The priest is the one that has to kill and prepare the lambs. And you know, during the time of Jesus, sometimes there were 250,000 Passover lambs killed on Passover. 250,000 Passover lambs. And they had to be done by the Levitical priests. And then the father would take the lamb and take it to his house for the meal. But in the upper room, there's no mention of a lamb and no mention of a priest. Except there is a lamb. Who is it? It's Jesus. And there's a priest. That's Jesus as well. He's both the victim and the priest. He's both of them. And then he says, he holds up this bread. And he says, this is my body. Now, I imagine myself, Steve Ray the Baptist, reclining at table with Jesus and saying to him, oh, excuse me, Jesus, you just said that piece of bread is your body. I think you made a mistake. You should reword what you just said. There's going to be a billion Catholics someday that think you really meant what you just said. So why don't you reword it now and save all the confusion and just say this represents my body, because we can all see it's a piece of bread. Can you imagine me, Steve Ray, saying something like that? People who know me said, yeah, I can imagine you saying that. But that would be the most audacious thing, because Jesus said, I have longed for this night. He's longed for the night when they're going to have this meal. Why? Because it is what he's come for. It's the covenant meal. It's where he's making a covenant with his new church, with his new people. And it's a nuptial. It's like a marriage. The marriage is taking place. What happens at a marriage? The groom gives his body to the bride, and the bride receives his body into herself. And they become one. And Jesus is here in very marital, covenantal language, saying, this is my body which I'm giving for you. And then they eat that. They bring him into their selves. And there's a unity. This is a nuptial meal. And in the Old Testament, you had to eat the meat of the lamb before you left, right? Well, there is no lamb there. The lamb is Jesus, and he's giving them his body. That's why he said, this is my body. Take and eat. Why? Because this is the meat of the lamb, and we can't get up and leave from this room until we eat the meat of the lamb. And he gives them his body to eat. There's so much more I could say about that. But Augustine said that when Jesus said, this is my body, that he was holding his own flesh in his own hands. Therefore, we must adore before we eat. Then I want to come to John chapter 6, because John chapter 6 is quite spectacular. When I was a Baptist, I used to love to hear Catholics talk about John chapter 6, because they were convinced it was all about their Eucharist. They would hear about it, eat my flesh and drink my blood, and they'd get so proud. Their chests would puff out. This is the Eucharist. This is what we're talking about. Can't you see this, Steve Ray the Baptist? Can't you see it? He says it right here. For us, it was all symbolic language. It wasn't real. It was symbolic. And I waited till we got to verse 63 of that chapter, because at verse 63, I cut you off at the kneecaps. 63 was my verse. I would let you prattle on and on and on about John chapter 6, eat my flesh and drink my blood. But when we got to John chapter 63, verse 63, that's when I cut you right off at the kneecaps, and Catholics had nothing to say. I'm going to save that verse for a little bit later. I'll let you hang on that one for a minute. Jesus is on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. He multiplied loaves and fish at least twice. Once on the eastern shore and once on the western. That's kind of cool, actually, because on the eastern shore is where the Jews lived. On the western shore, on the western shore is where the Jews lived. On the eastern shore, and I know right where it was, where he multiplied loaves over there, that is for the Gentiles lived over there. It was part of the Decapolis, which means that he multiplied loaves and fish also for Gentiles, and that's good news for us, because how many of you are Jewish? He's already promising he's going to give you miraculous bread as well, even before he ever instituted the Eucharist. And the people that were there, 5,000 men, how many people though? Just as 5,000 men. If you say each man has a wife and each one has a couple of kids and maybe there were servants, you're talking 20,000 people. They only counted the men. So over on the other side in a grassy area, they're hungry. They've been out there for 3 days. Jesus says they have no food. If you've ever heard the homily that says that Jesus just taught the people to share and they all took the bread out from under their robes and shared it with everybody else, that's nonsense. There's a denial of the miraculous. This was a real miracle. Jesus said they have no food. Give them food. And the disciples said, what are we going to give them? This is 3 years. That's a year's wage. So Jesus said, he gives them the loaves and the fish. People ate. They had their bellies full. These are hungry people. These are people that didn't have supply lines coming from Mexico and from Texas to bring steaks and things. And you know, if you have a bad weather here in Oregon and Washington, they still get food because it comes from somewhere else. They didn't have that there. If there was no rain 1 year, they were hungry the next year. And so when they get free food, this is a marvelous thing. And so Jesus, and it's night, and he walks on the water back to Capernaum. These people go all the way around the northern shore of Galilee, past Bethsaida. They come back around to his house where he's living with Peter in Capernaum. And in the morning, he wakes up, and there's 5,000 plus men again at his front porch. He gets out of bed, and he walks out there, and he says, are you all here because you're hungry again? It's exactly what he says. I know why you're here, because your bellies were full yesterday and you've come back for more free food now. That's how people get elected, by giving people free stuff. They all like free stuff. So they came back to Jesus to get more. And by the way, in that very chapter, they wanted to elect him to be the king. Why? Because he gave them free stuff. Then he says to them, I'm going to use this as an example. He says, you came here and you want bread. I'm going to tell you a spiritual application to this, that I have a bread, a food that if you eat of it, you will never be hungry again. Well, these hungry people are very excited. You mean we'll never be hungry again, never have to go to the grocery store? What a savings for our family budget. And give us this bread. And Jesus said, I am the bread which came down from heaven, pointing to himself. Now, I am not like the manna. So right there, there's the parallel. He says, as the manna, which was the bread of the angels, it's called in Psalm 106, as the manna came down from heaven, they ate of it, they still died. I am the bread which came down from heaven. If you eat of me, you will never die. And they're puzzled. Show us your hands, they say. And Jesus holds out his hands. He said, look at your hands. They're all calloused. There's scars. We know who you are. You're Jesus, the rock mason. That's what carpenter means. Somebody who works with hard materials. And in Nazareth, the hard materials they worked with was stone. Jerusalem limestone. That's what they did all day. Ching, ching, ching. No OSHA goggles, nothing in their hands were all. I took a rock home from Israel one time. I was going to break it and give it to a bunch of friends. I took it down to my workshop. I took the sledgehammer. I held that. Bam! And poof, immediately I had 6 bleeding cuts in my hand because that rock sent shards out. Jesus and Joseph, that's what they did. They worked with rocks. Show us your hands. Look at your hands. They're all calloused. They're all bloody and scarred. Don't tell us you just came down from heaven. What are you talking about? We know your mother and father. And Jesus, then you would think that he would back off and say, well, I'm only speaking symbolically. But he says, I am the bread. This is the bread which came down from heaven. And when he says that, if you eat of this bread, the Greek word is estheo, to eat. In Greek, see, we have such a disadvantage reading the Bible in English, because we read John chapter 6 and we only see one word for eat. Eat, 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 eat bread, eat bread, eat bread, eat my flesh, eat my... But in the Greek, there are different words and they're powerful, the word differences. So when you hear, he says, eat the bread, it's the word lechem, which means bread. That's why Bethlehem means house of bread. Bet is house. Lechem is bread. House of bread. By the way, Mary went to Bethlehem to give birth to Jesus because she went to the house of bread to deliver the bread. So, that's true. So Bethlehem, and so eat is estheo, polite dining, kind of what you guys are going to do after my talk for lunch. You're just going to eat polite dining, okay? And you're going to eat lechem, which means bread, food. But then when Jesus, they say, this is crazy. What are you talking about? You're the bread. You're not. And he then, instead of backing off and say, I'm only speaking symbolically, he ups the ante. He comes right back at him with a second barrel of the shotgun. And he says to them, unless you eat my flesh, no longer bread. Now it's not the word lechem, it's the word sarx, which means red meat. Unless you eat my sarx, my flesh, and drink my blood. The word eat, in now he changes the word eat from estheo to trogo. And from now on it's trogo, 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 the word eat. And the trogo means to munch, to gnaw, to chew, to masticate. It gives you the image of a dog chewing on a bone. Unless you gnaw in my flesh, there's no life in you. No wonder they're scandalized. No wonder they started to walk away. They said, this is a hard saying. We can do it. We can't even eat. The Jews had such a limited diet. We can't eat human flesh. We can't even eat lobsters and crabs. And what? We can't eat bacon. But you tell us we have to eat your flesh and drink blood. Leviticus, the book of Leviticus, forbids the drinking or eating of blood because the life is in the blood. Therefore, you are not permitted to. So when you have the 4th of July party and you invite your Jewish neighbor over, if they're a religious Jew anyway, they can't come over and eat the steak with you, because when you go buy the steaks, the filet mignons at the grocery store, they're in that cellophane and they're in a pool of blood because you want it to be a nice juicy steak. And it's still got the blood in it. And you put that on the grill. Oh, I can smell it already. But the Jews can't do that because it has the blood in it. The Jews have to kill their animals differently. We shoot the cow in the head and then butcher him. They have to cut his throat, hang him up by his back legs, and drain every drop of blood out of that bull or that cow or sheep before they can cook it so there's no meat. And Jesus is saying you have to drink my human blood? No wonder the Jews walked away. They were scandalized. And when I was a Baptist, I walked away with the unbelieving Jews, because I didn't give Jesus a chance to really explain what he meant. Jesus then looks at Peter and he says to Peter, are you going to go too? Peter says, this is what Peter really said. You have to read between the lines in the Bible sometime. Peter just heard Jesus say all of this to him. Peter says, you know what? We have no idea what you're talking about. Jesus just lost 20,000 disciples. Now there's just these 12 guys left. Peter says, I have no idea what you're talking about. We don't know what you mean by all of this, but what we do know is you're not from around here. You're a space alien. You've come from somewhere else outside. You've come down to this planet to teach us things that we could never know with the gray cells between our brains. You've come down to give us a revelation from God, and so we have learned that if we stay with you long enough, you'll always help us to understand, even though we don't understand it now, and you have the words of eternal life, so we're staying with you. That's what Peter really said. And Jesus then, he said, now comes the verse that I used against you. Jesus said, my words are spirit and life. They're mystery. They're power. They're beyond your capability of understanding with the gray matter between your ears. Then he says, my words are spirit and life. The flesh profits nothing. Did you hear that? He's just been talking about his flesh. My flesh, my flesh, my flesh. And now he says the flesh profits nothing. Cut you Catholics right off at the kneecaps. How do you answer that question, that flesh profits nothing? Maybe he was speaking symbolically. But then you realize that there, if you help one passage of the Bible helps interpret another passage of the Bible. So if you start reading, you'll find that in Matthew 26, you find the same words used. They are falling asleep with Jesus. And he said, the spirit is willing, but what does he mean by the flesh? This, me and my human body, apart from the revelation of God. How can I understand? He said, my words are spirit and life, mystery, great mystery. How can you ever understand that without the revelation of God? The flesh profits nothing. I can prove to you that the flesh profits nothing, and that you are deceived all the time by your five puny little senses: smelling, tasting, hearing, seeing, and touching. Those are your five senses. And our world today says that if it's not sensed by those four things, it doesn't exist, those five. And so we fall for that lie. And we say, well, it's bread and wine because it still tastes like bread and wine. I don't believe in it. But your senses lie to you about things all the time. I have a half shekel here. It even has the harp of David on it. Do any of you think that you can tear this in half, bend it, or look through it? Is this a solid? You're not sure? It's a solid, right? Your senses already lied to you about the substance of this coin, because if you go to high school in physics 101, you learn that this coin is made up of atoms. And atoms are tiny little particles of electrons, neutrons, and protons that spin around in space. An atom is 99.999% space. It is not a solid. But because it moves so fast, it deceives our senses into thinking it's a solid. This coin is made up of atoms. It is 99.9% space. I should be able to tear it, look at it, bend it, see through it, but I can't because my senses lie to me about the substance of that coin. And my senses lie to me about the substance that's on the altar too. Jesus already told us what it was. And I believe it not because it tastes like blood and raw meat, because I know what they taste like. I believe it because of what Jesus said. St. Augustine one time was walking along the beach, and this is a true story. And he was trying to think about the Trinity. Think. Two, three and one, one and three, how does this work? And there was a little boy standing on the side of the beach, and he had dug a little hole in the sand. He went to the ocean, got the water, came and put it in the hole. Then he went to the water and got some more and put it in the hole. Augustine says to him, what are you doing, little boy? He says, sir, I'm going to take all the water in the ocean and put it in my hole. And Augustine says, stand up, boy, and look, that ocean is infinite. There's no way you can get all of that water into your little hole. And the little boy stood up and looked at Augustine and said, and neither, sir, will you understand all the mysteries, infinite mysteries of God with your little head. A friend of mine said to me, Steve, when you become Catholic, I can prove to you that that what you say is the body and blood of Christ is not. It's really only bread and wine or grape juice. I said, how can you do that? His name was Jim. He was a biochemist at 40. He had his own laboratory in his house for all of these things with microscopes and everything. He even raised a two-headed snake one time. I saw the snake. I mean, this guy, he could do all these things. He said, when you become Catholic, I want you to go to Mass. And when you eat the Eucharist, an hour later, I want you to come to my house. I want you to vomit up the Eucharist, and we're going to put it in my microscope, and if it shows a carbohydrate, that means it's still bread. If it shows it's a protein, then I'll have to bend a little bit on my beliefs and say maybe it became the flesh of Christ. He said, will you do it? And what would you say? I said, yes. You got to know who I am. I'm Jerusalem Jones. I'm not an average guy. So I said yes, but in the same time I asked the Lord, how should I respond? He said, say yes, but ask him this question. Came to my mind that fast. Jesus promised he'd do that sometimes. I said, okay, Jim, let me give you a hypothetical question because I want to see what your microscope can really do. He said, okay. I said, pretend we're in Capernaum and this curly-haired Jewish guy is coming up the trail here, the path, and he's got camel dung between his toes and there's flies buzzing around his head and he smells a perspiration, and I say, is that Yeshua? And everybody says, yeah, that's Jesus right there. Okay, good. I take my knife and I go over to Jesus and I cut the tip off of his finger. One time I did it with the wrong edge and I was bleeding for the rest of the talk, so I'm real careful. So I said, I take the knife and I cut his finger off and I bring it to you and put it in your microscope. Would you be able with your microscope to detect the divinity of Christ? And he said, no, I would only be able to detect his humanity. Microscopes can't detect divinity. I said, but Jim, you're a Baptist. You believe that Jesus is 100% man and 100% God, but with your microscope, you would have to deny his divinity. What good's it going to do to test the Eucharist? And he says, touche, but I'll be back. He wasn't interested in learning. He only wanted to argue and fight. I don't believe that it's the body and blood of Christ because it tastes like meat and wine and blood. It's because Jesus said so, and he came from heaven to tell us that. And the church has taught it for 2,000 years without wavering. In my book, Crossing the Tiber, I have a little chapter called A Short History of the Resistance. There was no resistance to the Eucharist until the Protestant Reformation started. And then they started to deny that. But all through history, it's always been that way. I've got two more minutes. So I want to just end with this. When I went to my first Mass, I remember thinking about this. I'd never been in a Catholic Mass before. It was the first time. It was January 1st, 1994, the day before I had decided by reading books I was going to be a Catholic. Still never been in a Catholic church, met a Catholic who could explain or defend their faith, never met a priest. And I remember sitting there, a friend invited us to go. He said, now that you've decided to be Catholic, why don't you come to Mass with us? Oh boy, that was something new. I never dreamed of. By reading my way into the church, I'd have to go to a Catholic Mass. So we did. And I sat there and I saw this about the Eucharist. I remember Jesus, and here's a verse I used to use against you. Jesus, four times in the Bible it says that Jesus was crucified once and for all for the forgiveness of sins. If he was crucified once and for all, why do you Catholics sacrifice him over and over and over and over and over and over and over again on your altars? I know why, because you don't read your Bibles. If you read your Bibles, you would know he was only sacrificed once and for all. But you don't know that, so you think you have to come for another sacrifice, another sacrifice. Is Jesus Christ crucified over and over and over again? What I realized at that Mass was that God, outside of space and time, he is existence. He created the universe like a bubble. And in the bubble is space and time. We're stuck in the bubble. He's outside. He is eternal. He is existence itself. We're stuck in this little bubble that he created called the universe, space and time. And one day he came down and came into the bubble. Bloop. And he walked around for 33 years inside the bubble. He was crucified, died, buried, and rose again once and for all in the bubble of space and time. And then, boop, back out of the bubble again, back into heaven. So I was right. It was once and for all. But you got to remember, God is no longer, he's not in space and time. Everything to him is an eternal event. And I remembered the verses that my mother made me memorize out of the Protestant Bibles in Revelation 13:8. It said Jesus Christ was crucified before the foundations of the world. How could he be crucified before the foundations of the world if he was crucified once and for all? Because in God's mind, it's all one big eternal event. 1 John 2:2, he is your sacrifice. It didn't say he was, he is now, today. When you go to confession, you're praying and having your sins confessed based on his sacrifice, that he is your sacrifice today. And in Revelation chapter 5, verse 8, it says that I looked into heaven, I saw standing on the altar in front of the throne of God, a lamb with his throat slit and yet alive. That's the Passover lamb. What does God see when he wakes up? And he yawns and he does his cup of coffee. What's the first thing he sees? Is the lamb. The Passover lamb, Jesus on the cross, right in front of him. It's an eternal event, past, present, and future. This is what I saw when I sat there. So what happens at the Mass? It's not another sacrifice of Christ. But we're stuck in space and time, and God knows that we need the body and blood of his son. We know that we need that nutrition. So he comes back with that altar at the hands of the priest. Eternity come, bam, right down onto the altar. And you partake of that eternal sacrifice. It is not another sacrifice. It is the representation of the one eternal sacrifice that did happen in space and time. But in God's eyes, it's one big eternal sacrifice. And it comes right back down on the altars on Sunday. And you partake of an eternal sacrifice because we need the body and blood of Christ. And lastly, it's like the sun. In the old days, the ancients thought that the sun raced across the sky and then it died. Poor sun! But another one was born in the morning and it raced and burned its way out and died, went down, buried, new one comes up. But then we got in the space shuttle and we realized, wait a minute, the sun doesn't die. We're only thinking it does because we're this flesh profits nothing. We don't see the whole picture from the earth. When we get outside, we say, look, the sun is eternal, so to speak. It's always there. It's us that spin around. And every day the sun represents itself. It's not a new sun. It's the one eternal sun that represents itself every day. Why? Because we can't live without the S-O-S-U-N. And it represents, it's not a new sun. And every day the sun, S-O-N, rises on us again. It's not a new S-O-N. It's not a new sacrifice of Christ on the cross. It's that one eternal sacrifice representing it to us. Because without the S-O-N, we can't live either. And I did it, and I'm on time. So thank you.